of its members that our system.
If there's one thing the Occupy movement has made crystal clear, it's that the American middle class is in trouble in ways this country hasn't seen for decades. But where to pin the blame? Jacob Hacker directs the Institute for Social and Policy Studies at Yale University, and he's the co-author of the book Winner Take All Politics: How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. He tells Steve Paulson the middle class really is the 99%.
Well, I think that most Americans believe that they're middle class. When you do polls, what you find is that about 80% of Americans say that they are middle class. And when they talk about the middle class, they mean more than just an income category. They mean a certain set of ideals, you know, the idea that if you work hard and you play by the rules, you can get ahead, that your kids will have a better life than you, that you're not living at the bottom where you have to worry about making ends meet day to day. What I want to say is that the middle class, understood as, say, everyone below the top 10% or top 1%, has clearly lost enormous ground over the last generation. As many of the sort of things we used to take for granted, like a stable pension and good health care benefits, has come under fire, and as people have started to feel as if that American dream, if you work hard and play by the rules, you'll get ahead and your kids can get ahead, is no longer perhaps as resonant as it once was.
So you're saying the middle class now is different than it was, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, I don't think that our ideals for the middle class are that different, but I think the middle class is feeling a huge amount of strain right now. The period from the end of World War II until the 1970s featured very strong growth across the income distribution. It didn't occur automatically. There was the GI Bill that helped people go to college. There was home mortgage efforts. There was massive infrastructure development. There was investment in science and education, all of which helped create this broad middle class that had security through Medicare and Social Security and through private health insurance and pensions. Since the 1970s, something has happened, where most of the gains have gone to the very top. I mean, the numbers are really staggering. From the late 1970s until just before the Great Recession of the last few years, we saw about 40% of all household income gains go to the richest 1% of Americans. Over the last decade, it's been more than half that has gone to the richest 1%. I think that really helps explain why there's this sense that the middle class is losing ground.
So you're saying that income for the vast majority of Americans has stagnated or perhaps even dropped, let's say, over the last decade. But for that top 1%, it's shot through the roof.
That's absolutely true. We know this now far better than we did 10 or 15 years ago because of the work of a whole set of economic specialists and sociologists who have looked at income tax statistics. So the shares of income going to the very top have essentially gone through the roof. Two illustrations. In the late 1970s, roughly around 10% of income was being taken home by the richest 1% of taxpayers. In 2007, it was around 24%, which is just an enormous increase. If you look at the very top, say the top 0.1%, we're talking about the highest share in 2007 that has ever been received by that group. 1 in 1,000 households in 2007 were taking home $1 in $8 in our economy. That is a remarkable development, and we do not see it in other rich democracies. No other country has experienced that kind of massive skew toward the very top.
You're saying there are specific political decisions that have been made that have produced this growing inequality.
Well, we know that's the case for two reasons. One is we know that the United States has been distinctive in the degree to which these broad pressures have created this massive run-up of incomes at the top, coupled with stagnant or even declining earnings in the middle and the bottom. The second reason we know this is that we can actually find the policies that matter. My favorite example here is if you think about financial deregulation, right? The Wall Street explosion was a huge aspect of the run-up of incomes at the very top. If you look at the richest 0.1% of taxpayers, about 60% are executives. Of those 60%, I think 1/3 or so is financial executives. So that's a big part of the story. And a big part of the story is capital gains and what's happened at the very top.
Can you explain that a little bit more? So you're saying that what enriched Wall Street was deregulation, specific policies that allowed Wall Street to make more money. What specifically were some of those things that were deregulated?
Well, you go back into, first of all, the lifting of a lot of restrictions on banking activities, on interest rates that could be charged, relaxation of the rules governing derivatives. And then at the same time, there was a deliberate effort across Republican and Democratic administrations not to use the enforcement tools that were in the hands of regulators. We tell a story in the book of the SEC head, Arthur Levitt, going to Phil Gramm, the Republican from Texas who was chairing the Senate Banking Committee, and saying, we really need to tighten up accounting standards. Things are getting out of hand. And this is before Enron. And what Phil Gramm said to him, I think, was sort of inadvertently prescient. He said, unless the waters are crimson with the blood of investors, I don't want you engaging in any regulatory flights of fancy. So it was there was a deliberate policy of non-interference, as well as a tearing down of a whole architecture that was designed to prevent conflicts of interest, prevent systemic risk. And that's what came home to roost with the financial crisis. So the point is that government isn't some kind of passive agent that just redistributes income after the fact. Public policies basically help create the massive boom on Wall Street that enriched so many people.
But I guess the argument on the other side is that there was a lot of money out there to be made if you deregulated. Why not loosen things up and turn Wall Street on fire, see what they could do? And why would that necessarily come back to hurt the middle class?
Actually, there's enough research now on this to suggest that countries that have very large financial sectors do not grow more quickly than other countries. There was a lot of money to be made, but who was making that money? I mean, what happened with Wall Street was basically gains were privatized among a very small circle of people, and losses were socialized across society as a whole.
Obviously, this is all highly relevant to what we're seeing with the Occupy Wall Street movement. The usual criticism of Occupy Wall Street is that there's this kind of unfocused anger, and they don't really know what they want. I mean, yes, there's rage against huge profits on Wall Street, but is there anything concrete that comes out of this? Is that a valid criticism?
It is valid criticism, but I think it misses the reality that there's a very focused critique embodied in many of the Occupy Wall Street protesters' claims. To me, the most effective slogan, the most powerful message that's come out of Occupy Wall Street is the other 99%, right? And I just pointed out that most of the income gains of the last generation went to the top 1%. So saying the other 99% is actually pretty powerful. There is a very heavy emphasis in these protests on the fact that the 99%, particularly younger Americans who are just coming into this terrible job market, are drowning in debt, particularly college loan debt, that they don't feel that the opportunities that I talked about earlier that were embodied in the American dream are really there for them. There's a villain, and it's not just Wall Street, right? It's a sense that the political system isn't working. People who have tons of money, tons of connections are able to get what they want, but most Americans don't have that kind of influence. So I think it's actually a pretty powerful critique. That said, for these kinds of movements to have influence over the long term, they'll have to hook up with, for want of a better word, elite agendas, right? There'll have to be some people who carry that message into Washington politics.
Now, it's worth pointing out that you are not just a Yale professor. You, I think, are widely considered part of the brain trust of progressive policymakers, to some degree, of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And a few years ago, the New York Times called you the intellectual it boy of the Democrats. You played a very prominent role in formulating the public option in healthcare. Are you saying that the Democratic Party has to distance itself from Wall Street? Does it have to some degree?
Well,
align itself with the Occupy Wall Street movement?
To some extent, yes. I think it has to distance itself. And it's being distanced whether it wants to or not. You know, Mitt Romney is pulling in more money than Obama from Wall Street. Wall Street shifted very heavily towards the Republicans in the run-up to the 2010 election.
But Wall Street was often a big ally during the 2008 election that elected
Obama. That's correct. And it was a big ally during the 1990s and 2000s when a lot of these deregulatory changes were taking place. But I think that was an unholy alliance that really hurt the Democrats' ability to present a clear and alternative vision on these economic issues. So yes, they have to distance themselves. They also have to think longer term. And if Occupy Wall Street is going to have a positive effect, I think one of the things it might do, right, is to create some organizational presence on these issues that lasts beyond one particular election campaign. I am optimistic, not for this, you know, next year or the next 2 years, but over the longer term, that there will be the development of a broader organized pressure on these issues. I think this has been such a catalyzing experience for so many people who are concerned about the shift of our country from a democracy toward an oligarchy, that there's going to be a lot of effort on a lot of fronts to try to create sustained organizational presence to push back on these issues.
Jacob Hacker is a political scientist at Yale and the co-author of Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
got to find some cook who can cook my books like those Wall Street analysts and mortgage lending crooks. Lots of laws and regulations to abuse. And I'm sick to death of writing IOUs. Got those used to be in the middle class. Mad as hell, you can bet you're used to be in the middle class blues.